Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Time to do the electronic version of checking your wallet to make sure everything's in it that's supposed to be. A cybercrime ring has set a new record for the number of credit cards it hacked and compromised. 130 million. Like I said, check your wallets. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
American Public Media presents After the Bell, a weekly podcast that makes sense of the week in business and the economy, available at marketplace.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks for joining us on this Tuesday. It is the 18th day of August. So how does a fraud happen on such a massive scale? Well, basically, the thieves figured out some security algorithm that was being used by a credit card processing company, and they used that information to swipe numbers from five major retailers, including 7-Eleven. The fraud involves an American suspect named Albert Gonzalez, based in Miami, and Russian accomplices. For a look at how and why these massive thefts continue, despite the best efforts of law enforcement, we turn to Ted Crooks. He is vice president of Global Analytics, and he helps banks come up with solutions to credit fraud problems. Thanks so much for talking to us.
My pleasure.
Where was the failure here? Consumers, retailers, banks, some sort of middleman?
It's a shared responsibility because the payment system is like a giant refinery with tubes and pipes and valves everywhere. And you are going to get leaks occasionally, and the system has to be built so that it can withstand some of those leaks. And this is one case where a leak got completely out of control.
So who takes the hit here? Who loses their shirt? Consumers really aren't held responsible, right?
Generally not. Under rare conditions, a financial institution might try to pin it on a consumer, especially on a debit card, because they're not as protected as credit cards.
Hmm.
But in general, 99 9/10% of the loss will go to credit card issuing banks.
Is it true that banks and these payment gateway systems that we're hearing about, that they have access to technology that could prevent this, but they don't always use it?
Well, that's a little self-serving for me to answer that, because that's the kind of stuff I build and our company does. But yes, there's always more technology that could be supplied, and much of it, of course, I think would be very worthwhile. But banks have to judge, is that extra bit of technology going to really save enough money to make it worthwhile? The fraudsters will no doubt adapt around it eventually, so this is a never-ending arms race. Also, if one bank gets ahead of the next bank, well, then that other bank will catch up as well, and they all end up at parity again. They're more concerned about how they stand with competition than the absolute amount of fraud.
I've read that European credit cards actually have more protections than those in the U.S. Why is that?
Yes, the cards are more secure, but it's caused a bigger fraud problem. The U.K., for example, shifted over to a secure chip-based card that has an integrated circuit in the card and requires a PIN number anytime you use it. And the electronics is very secure, but actually fraud has gone up substantially as a consequence of implementing it. And the reason was that even though the fraud is more difficult, it's now more valuable because the same PIN you use to buy gas at a gas station, you use to get cash out of an ATM.
You know, is this kind of thing simply a fact of life at this point? Are we going to look back in a few years and say 130 million credit cards? Child's play.
Well, it's actually much less serious than it was some time back. About 15 years ago, fraud was much worse than it is now. Better technology was brought to play and has reduced fraud, and now it's starting to creep back up, and these compromises are only one aspect of it. It's a serious problem for the industry and for economic policymakers, but it's not really a big threat for individual cardholders.
I guess even if consumers shouldn't be losing sleep at night, the advice remains, check your credit reports as often as you can.
Well, the big thing is, if you're really worried about it, use your credit card more often than your debit card. If you can keep your balance down and pay it off every month, the credit card's safer. And secondly, do keep track of your bills first. Look at those bills you get from the card company and make sure that there's nothing on there you don't recognize. and then check your credit report. And you can do that three times a year for free.
All right. Excellent advice. Ted Crooks is Vice President of Global Analytics. Thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So riddle me this. What does a criminal mastermind, assuming you call them that, do with 130 million credit card numbers? How exactly do fraudsters make money? Marketplace's Rico Galliano looked into the business model.
Well, that's easy, right? Pick a number, log on to Amazon, and start buying stuff. Jonathan Penn is vice president at Forrester Research. He says it's a bit more complicated. In fact,
complicated, I don't think, does justice to the level of maturity of the economy around stolen data.
He describes a network of players at different levels. Harvesters, like allegedly Albert Gonzalez, fall somewhere in the middle of the network. They make their money by stealing all those millions of data records and selling them to wholesalers. And the wholesalers then sell the records online, one at a time, to other criminals.
And it goes, you know, it can go for a few cents for a record. It may be 10 times that. You know, credit card numbers on their own are worth less than credit card numbers in conjunction with other personal information like your name, your social security number, or even things like your pet's name.
Wired.com senior editor Kevin Polson knows all about what happens next. A former hacker, he created Wired's security blog, Threat Level. He says criminals take the stolen records they've purchased and program them onto the magnetic stripe of, say, old gift cards.
They'll use anything. They'll use phone cards, anything that that has a magnetic stripe on it. And if it's a case where PIN numbers were stolen, then they can go to an ATM, put the card in the ATM, put in the PIN, and pull out cash from people's accounts.
Polson says most recent examples of that scam and similar ones allegedly involved Gonzalez.
With his latest indictment, Gonzalez now ties up every major credit or debit card breach we know about over the past 5 years. It all comes back to him.
If so, this still isn't the end of data theft. Jonathan Penn of Forrester Research says it's estimated to be a multi-billion dollar market, possibly even bigger than the illegal drug trade. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
Our online host, Scott Jagow, is blogging about hackers and credit card companies and the safety of your personal information. You can join the conversation on the Scratchpad at marketplace.org. Profit margins for rental car companies these days are about as narrow as the shoulder on a backcountry road. Hertz is really hurting. Its year-over-year profits in the latest quarter were down 92%, which may help explain why the company is looking at a novel way of pinching pennies. Bloomberg reports that Hertz is testing a new high-resolution photography system. It would scan cars for dents and dings before and after a rental. No more circling the car with a diagram and crossing your fingers that you don't miss something. Here's our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon.
I rent cars all the time, and I can tell you, be prepared for some companies to inspect every last inch when you return your car as intensely as if they were trying to decipher the fine print in their contract. In fact, industry consultant Neil Abrams says the standard car rental contract almost always holds you responsible for all damage.
It doesn't speak to minor damage or major damage. It speaks to damage to the vehicle. You bring the vehicle back in the same condition you took it. That is the customer's responsibility.
Some customers have taken to snapping pictures of existing damage with their cell phones. Hertz spokesman Richard Broom says the company is essentially experimenting with doing the same thing with a very sharp image.
This technology, if it pans out for us, eliminates waits for customers on the front end of the rental, and we have a clear and accurate picture of the state of the car. It's dings and dents, scrapes and scratches before it leaves the lot, and then we repeat the process at the end of the rental so that we have an accurate record of before and after.
Paul Lanie is a frequent traveler from Minneapolis. We caught up with him today on a business trip to Las Vegas, and as someone who rents cars a lot, he likes the idea.
You know, it's always subjective. They say there's nicks on the door. Well, yeah, there are. But what if I put more nicks on the door? Who's to assess which nicks were there first? So the idea of photographic evidence, I think, would have a good potential of avoiding conflicts down the road.
Hertz told us today the vast majority of renters are careful to take good care of their cars, and the company isn't looking to charge for every tiny scratch. But consultant Neil Abrams says they almost can't afford not to. Consider the take on the average rental contract is $20.
If they have to repair a scratch or a ding, chances are it's going to cost you more than $20. You've given away the profit if you don't collect on that damage.
And you guessed it. That ultimately means even careful customers get dinged with higher rates. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
On Wall Street, a rebound from the Monday blues. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Those of you with kids don't need me to remind you what season we're in. No, not summer. Back to school shopping season. It's the second biggest shopping period of the year behind Christmas. Or at least it's supposed to be. But with just a couple of weeks till school begins, it's more like recess. A survey out today from the National Retail Federation says the average family still has a lot of room in the backpack for items on the back-to-school shopping list. Tamara Keith reports.
Ah, back to school shopping. The mechanical pencils and glitter pens, the latest sneakers, that perfect outfit to wear on the first day of school. But only if it's on sale. Ellen Davis, vice president of the National Retail Federation, says parents won't be pushed this year.
They want to make sure that kids have everything they need, but the days where a kid goes and points at everything they want and the parent puts it in the shopping cart are over.
Davis says families that were surveyed plan to spend about $550. That's $50 less than last year. A third of families haven't even started shopping yet. You can put Northern California mom Tammy Ray Scott in that category. Her son will be a second grader, and her daughter is going into fifth grade.
We have a couple of weeks, and I think I can slam dunk it in 2 days.
Scott says clothes are a must, particularly for her fashion-conscious daughter.
They need stuff for the winter, and they've definitely outgrown things that they wore last year.
This is what retailers count on. Adrian Tennant is a retail analyst at FBR Capital Markets. She specializes in the stores where teenagers shop.
Abercrombie, American Eagle, PacSun, Hot Topic.
She says there are some distinctive trends pulling teens into the stores. Plaids, the boyfriend shirt, skinny jeans.
There's some reason to be optimistic, but I won't tell you that price is not key. I mean, it's all about the guy who can give you the best value, the right trend at a decent price.
And if history is any guide, the deals will keep getting better the closer we get to Labor Day. In Washington, I'm Tamara Keith for Marketplace.
One item more and more school kids are expected to have is a laptop computer. Sounds financially onerous for many families, but these days you don't have to spend the GDP of a small country to buy one. Today, Hewlett-Packard reported second quarter earnings of $1.6 billion, and the company's netbooks get some of the credit. Netbooks are mini laptops, originally conceived as cheap computers that could be used in the developing world. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith tells us their new popularity here at home could spell big changes for the computer industry.
A netbook is kind of like a laptop light. They're about the size of a sheet of paper and roughly half an inch thick. They're not very powerful. You use them for the basics, emailing, surfing the web, writing a paper. In other words, what most of us use a computer for. The price? $200 to $300. Roger Kay heads up Endpoint Technologies.
The value proposition for a netbook is so simple that if you were doing an elevator pitch, you could get it off between the first floor and the second floor. Basically, it's something that you know for cheap.
Netbook sales have more than doubled over the last year. They now make up one of every five laptops sold, and that's caught the computer industry by surprise, because no one expected consumers would want a slower, less powerful machine. After all, the whole PC industry was built around selling the newer, faster, more powerful machine. Power's not an issue for Jeff Jennings, even though he runs the technical operations for FreeWire, a company that builds fan sites for celebrities. He bought an HP netbook a couple months ago, and he says, thanks to cloud computing, the little netbook and an internet connection are all he needs to do his job.
I can literally sit on my boat on the weekends, and if there's a problem, I fire up my netbook, I hop on a server in Germany, per se, help diagnose the problem or fix the problem and get it back up and running.
The price and portability of netbooks has transformed the computer business, says Bob O'Donnell, a tech analyst with IDC.
it's shaken up the market in terms of who the leading players are. It's shaken up the market in terms of the kinds of offerings that can be made. It's shaken up consumers' expectations around what computers can be.
Like fashion accessories, HP sold thousands of so-called digital clutches by designer Vivienne Tam. Disney offers netbooks for kids at Toys R Us featuring themes like WALL-E and Hannah Montana. Telecom companies are heavily promoting netbooks, too, because they can sell wireless plans for them. And that's got the computer industry worried about the future, that customers may decide they no longer need a $1,200 laptop with all the trimmings and can make do with a cheap computer and an expensive phone. I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, free lunch can mean big bucks for New Jersey schools.
To get additional resources through the formula, you have to make sure that the student is signed up and eligible for free and reduced lunch under the federal nutrition program.
But first, let's do the numbers. The bulls fought their way back on Wall Street today, thanks in large part to better-than-expected earnings from some major retailers. The Dow bounced back by 82 points, 0.9% to finish at 9,217. The Nasdaq rebounded 25 points, 1.3%, closing at 1955. The S&P regained 9 points, 1%, coming to rest at 989. After disappointing results from Lowe's yesterday, rival Home Depot turned in a better-than-expected profit report. Shares of the country's biggest home improvement retailer climbed more than 3%. Target's profit broke through the bullseye. The retailer's shares rang up more than 7%. Bond prices slipped, nudging the 10-year T-notes yield to 3.51%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Angie's List, providing first-hand consumer reviews on local services like plumbers, painters, movers, and now doctors. Details at angieslist.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
On the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. It was a big deal. Google went public just 5 years ago on August 19, 2004. President number 42 turned 63. It's Bill Clinton's birthday. And tomorrow is National Aviation Day. It's marked annually on the birth anniversary of Orville Wright. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl. It is almost college gridiron season. Teams are practicing in the summer heat to prepare for battle on the field. But another battle is happening off the field right now. The question is whether fans of the Gators, the Vols, the Tide, and other Southeastern Conference schools will be allowed to tweet and post live cell phone video from the stands. As Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports, the debate is all about TV broadcast rights.
There's a reason the Southeastern Conference is one of college football's most profitable enterprises. It's got a $3 billion exclusive contract with ESPN and CBS. And to protect that contract, the conference last week issued new rules for ticketed fans. No tweeting, no iPhone photos on Facebook, no video on YouTube. But after significant backlash, the organization today revised those rules to prohibit only live video streams. Andrew Zimbalist is a sports economist at Smith College. He says this is just the kickoff in a much larger battle to protect traditional media.
They're obviously being told by their contractors that they want exclusivity and they want protections.
But can fans armed with smartphones actually shrink TV audiences? Rafid Ali is the editor of paidcontent.org. He says the Southeastern Conference's policy exposes a fundamental misunderstanding of how people use social media sites.
There will probably be multitasking between what's on TV and what's online, or a live stream where you're probably watching your friend giving a commentary for something that's happening on the field.
Ali says all that Twittering, Facebooking, and YouTubing doesn't erode TV audiences. It boosts them and all the ad revenues they bring in.
I know that sounds a little ADD, but that's the reality of how things are at this point.
For college football's Big Ten, that reality is sinking in. Its new social media rules actually encourage fans to Twitter and YouTube. In Los Angeles, I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
We talked earlier in the show about how retailers are a tad worried this back-to-school shopping season. Will the deals on clothes, shoes, and computers go unheeded? Will pencils, notebooks, and locker decor languish on the shelves? Well, at least one segment of the school population will be shopping. Commentator and teacher Alan Tang raised his hand to tell us about it.
Nothing can ruin a teacher's vacation more than a back-to-school sale. Those four little words mark the end of summer. That's when teachers begin to worry about being ready for the next year. That's when the nightmares start. The ones where you're teaching with no pants on. The other problem with back-to-school sales is that teachers have to go. While these sales might have been designed for parents, trust me, teachers are the ones trying to hoard 30 sets of colored pencils. Unlike office jobs where you're free to steal from the supply closet, teachers get a very modest budget to last us the entire year. It's never enough for the 150 students you are assigned. So when we see the ads for one-cent erasers, our ears prick up. The office supply places used to invite us in. Now they cringe when they see us coming. It was perfect. Go to the register and check out with a year's worth of supplies for under $30. But once enough teachers caught on, there was barely anything left for the students. And with the shortages have come store limits. At most, 5 pencils. Limit, 10 protractors. But did that deter us? On the contrary. Once the radio and TV ads start running, teachers pounce on the Sunday paper. We zero in and circle the 19-cent glue sticks, limit 10, and go to every Office Depot in the county on the hunt for more. Sure, we come up empty a lot, and with gas prices, we're spending more on transportation than we're saving on supplies, but it's the principle. So for parents, a friendly warning. You do not want to come between a determined teacher and a stack of 10-cent notebooks.
Alan Tang teaches at Woodland Park Middle School in San Diego and is a coach with the San Marcos Writing Project. Your thoughts? Write to us at marketplace.org. In a couple of weeks, New Jersey kids file back into their classrooms. School funding is a contentious issue in most states, and Jersey is no exception. Courts have often had to weigh in on how funding should work in a state with widely varying income levels. This spring, a new funding formula got the seal of approval from the state's highest court, and it comes with a nutritional twist. Ashley Millentite reports.
New Jersey's formula now works like this. The state provides about $9,700 to educate each child to meet academic standards, but poor students in poor districts can get an extra $5,000 on top of that. That's where free lunch comes in. David Sciarra is executive director of Education Law Center in Newark.
In order to count a student as poor and to get additional resources through the formula, you have to make sure that the student is signed up and eligible for free and reduced lunch under the federal nutrition program.
The thinking is that children who qualify for free meals have greater educational needs overall. So for towns and cities with lots of poor kids, the race is on to sign them up for free lunch by a deadline of October 1st so they can get that extra funding. Newark has a 65% poverty rate, and most kids qualify for free lunch. Today, some of those kids are at summer basketball camp at Science Park High School. Father Brian Dunphy is running the camp.
We have awards for best character of the day. When you're not playing, the kids are over there. They have to be encouraging the other players out there, cheering for each other. You know, no trash talking, but just building each other up.
Science Park is one of Newark's newest schools. It has solar panels on the roof, soaring ceilings, and lots of computers in its pristine classrooms. Valerie Wilson is acting school business administrator for Newark Public Schools. She says like other schools in the district, this one has plenty of parents who balk at filling out forms for free lunch. She says many parents are immigrants, and some may be undocumented.
There are concerns that the data may be shared with other federal agencies, and we have a difficult time reassuring our parents who may in fact really qualify that they should fill out the application.
She says they don't share the data with the government. But it's not just parents who are reluctant. High schoolers don't like what they see as the stigma of getting a free lunch. Wilson says one way they've tried to deal with that is the technology they now use in their cafeterias. Right. Only the cashier can tell what your lunch status is. Your peers are in the dark.
This is a point of sale system. So here's the keypad that they would key in their student ID, and their name comes up automatically.
Wilson says school staff are about to embark on a blizzard of parent outreach. Letters and forms go out in several languages, including Portuguese and Creole. She says every parent should understand the implications of free and reduced lunch. If a kid isn't signed up, they lose out on more than a meal.
If you have a student who's struggling in order to qualify for supplemental educational services, which is tutoring, free of cost to the parents, that child has to have had a lunch application the previous year.
And missing forms mean the district loses out on money too. School starts on September 3rd. The Newark School District has set itself some homework. It wants 95% of its lunch application forms completed by the October 1st deadline. In Newark, I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
And this final note, victims of financial fraud are often out of luck when it comes to recouping their losses. Bernie Madoff's investors are pinning their hopes on a trustee who's trying to track where all those billions went. And they're starting to get refunds from the IRS for the taxes they paid on ghost gains. And then there's the tiny island of Antigua, victim of another alleged Ponzi schemer, Sir Alan Stanford. Stanford was apparently Antigua's largest employer until his arrest a couple of months ago. Riding to the island's rescue, the government of Venezuela, which offered $50 million to help prop up the Caribbean nation. Thousands of Venezuelans lost money in Stanford's alleged banking scheme. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow rose 82 points, 0.9%. The NASDAQ added 25 points, 1.3%. And the S&P gained 9 points, 1%. Thanks to Jennifer Collins and Renita Jablonski on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. Next time on the program, hiring foreign teachers stirs up local frustration.
If you had to take a chance on someone, why wouldn't you take a chance on those folks who are already available in the pool?
I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.